Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Pleased to have V.J. Pandian back with us today, horticulture agent and educator for UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. We'll talk to him about pruning brambles. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. What gardening questions do you have for him? You can join in by calling us at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. V.J. Pandian, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry. Glad to be here.
You know, just before the show, I walked by our front desk, and there are some, somebody brought in some purple hyacinth, potted purple hyacinth, and they smell wonderful. And I, every time I walk by them, I think about spring. And I think it's a wonderful thing to have at this time of the year because it gets us thinking about what's, you know, what's next for us in the garden, the flower garden or the vegetable garden or the fruit garden. And, you know, when I hear brambles, I think about raspberries and blackberries. And there are some other ones that are grown in Wisconsin, aren't there?
Yes. I mean, recently, last couple of years, I've been experimenting with boysenberry. And so it's a cross between multiple type of different type of blackberries and stuff like that. And, you know, it's very interesting to see that, you know, we can grow boysenberry in southern part of Wisconsin. So that's interesting to it's also part of the bramble family as well.
Yeah. What does the boysenberry taste like for those who aren't familiar with it?
So you think about blackberry in a steroid. So it's like a large-sized blackberry. But the good thing is that it is thornless, okay? This particular boysenberry is a thornless one. But it creeps out just like a blackberry. It crawls, you know? So each of those canes can grow about, like, you know, 3, 4, 5 feet, okay? And you need to have a trellis system just like growing, like, a grape wine in order to grow them. But it really tastes really good, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, and do you get a good yield from it?
So last year was my second year, and yes, I did get a little decent yield. So this year I'm expecting to double it. So last year I was able to harvest about, like, you know, from one plant about, like, you know, 6 or 8 1. So this year I'm hoping, you know, it might double up, you know. So once the root system is well established, you know, and then probably you may be able to, you know, increase the yield. So I'm still trying to figure out, you know, the proper pruning system for this boysenberry. So I know it's a, you know, one of the parent is a blackberry. So I'm trying to prune it just like a blackberry and see how it can be, you know, we can able to increase the production.
Sure.
And at the same time, remove some of those excess canes that comes out of this boysenberry, you know. So
yeah, well, you mentioned pruning, and it is important to prune brambles all of all types, raspberries, blackberries.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, now is one of the best time that you can prune them, you know. So the buds have not broken up yet. So before the bud break happens, now is the best time to prune those things. But just be a little bit patient. We are expecting a forecast of rain today and tomorrow as well to, say, schedule your pruning, you know, probably in a nice sunny day when it is dry. That will be the best time, so that way you can minimize the spread of any diseases as well. So when you're thinking about raspberries, you know that, you know, red raspberries, there are two different types. You have the yellow-bearing and the summer-bearing one. So the yellow-bearing one is the one that produces a crop beginning in August, goes all the way till the first frost hit in the fall time. So technically, we tend to advise many homeowners to prune the yellow-bearing raspberries in late fall. So the pruning is very simple. Just move it down to the ground. Cut all the canes down to the ground. But if you haven't pruned your yellow-bearing raspberries last fall, now is the time. Before the bud break happens up, you know, take a mower or take a lopper and cut it all the way down to the ground. And then you trash those, you know, crumbs, you know, chopped up canes. Now, the summer-bearing raspberries, which produce a bumper crop in the month of July, you know, that you may have to prune right now, as well as also in the middle of the summertime as well. So it needs two times pruning. So in the middle of the summertime, when you're done with the final harvest, prune those canes that produce the fruit. And so you cut those floaty canes, we call, you know, that's a cane that produces a fruit, cut it all the way down to the ground. And then during the dormant time, so right now, before the bud break happens, so you thin out some of the excess canes. So all those vegetative canes, you know, that we call it the primal canes. So these raspberries tend to produce so much excess amount of these vegetative canes, you know, it's hard to control them. So you thin some of those, you know, excess canes, leave only about like 4 to 5 sturdy canes. And remaining, you thin them out, you know. So every foot, leave about 4 to 5 sturdy canes. And, you know, that is actually can be done right now. And then sometimes you can also, you know, nip some of the tips of those canes as well. So if you see any actually frost damage happens up, that the tip of the canes turns into completely brown or completely blackish in color, you can nip some of those, you know, tips of those, you know, canes as well. But don't nip too much. If you do cut more than 1/4 of the canes, you know, then probably you end up in loss of the fruiting fruits. So just be careful about that.
Yeah, so that's raspberries. Blackberries, similarities, what do you do there?
So blackberries are a little bit different, okay? See, the difference between, you know, the pruning of the raspberries and the blackberries, especially the red raspberries and the blackberries, is that, you know, see, the red raspberries tend to produce those, you know, the suckers or the, you know, the buds, even along its root system, you know, not only the crown, along its root system, you know, so you get this dense vegetative things, you know. So in blackberries and stuff, you know, they produce most of the crowns, the buds comes from the crown. And in, you know, back in the time, you know, we tell them, you know, blackberries may not be really hardy. The cultivated blackberries may not be really hardy for the northern part of Wisconsin, you know. But nowadays, you know, with the global warming and stuff, who knows, you know, many people are, you know, are attempting to grow blackberries in Wisconsin. In fact, you know, I've been growing some blackberries too. So some of the varieties that has been recommended for growing blackberries in southern part of Wisconsin is the Primark 45, Prime Jim, and Prime Max. You know, these type of prime series are really good for southern part of Wisconsin. The reason is these type of blackberry cultivars, they produce fruits in the current season wood. So they produce the wood even in the primal cane itself, you know, the vegetative cane. So during in the growing season, so the first half they produce the leaves and the second half it starts producing actually the fruit, just like, you know, the summer, the fall bearing raspberries. So which means that these cultivars are very simple to prune. Just like fall bearing raspberry, you cut all the canes down to the crown, you know, in late fall. It's very simple. Or you can schedule the pruning probably in late winter, early spring, before the bud break happens. You mow them all the way down to the ground.
And in terms of, I'm thinking here and now as you're talking, I don't have any blackberries. Or I don't have any raspberry. I don't have beds. How does one... what do you do to get a blackberry or a raspberry bed started and going?
Okay. If you're new to, if you want to try some blackberry and you don't have much space, see, blackberry gets really gigantic. I think, you know, I tried growing in a bed about 8 feet by 8 feet. And this is my third year, and I tried actually the cultivar. That it produces the fruit in the first year itself, in the vegetative cane itself, which is our Primark 45, the name of the cultivar. It gets enormous, you know. It gets even filled up the entire bed, you know, 3/4 of my entire 8 feet bed. But thank God, the pruning is very simple. So in late fall or early in spring, you cut them down, all the way down to the ground. And, you know, and it start producing the canes probably in about late in the springtime. So in the second year, I thought I lost the care, you know, the blackberry, but it produces the cane very late in the season. And, you know, and wow, probably like in early fall, it started producing the fruits. So, but at the same time, I tried another variety, which is especially it's grown for in a tight spacing or a small spacing, which is called baby cakes. The name sounds interesting, but amazingly, it survived in southern part of Wisconsin, at least in southeast part of Wisconsin. So I planted it right in the same bed next to the Primark. And it's amazingly, it does really, it grows really well. And it's very compact and a little bit bushy in its growth. So you don't need that much spacing, about 2 or 3 feet, you know, that's pretty much. So, you know, so you can choose baby cakes. We can get it in many garden centers these days. I got it in one of the local garden centers a couple of years ago. And it has survived the winter, and it's easy to grow, and it's well-behaved. So just like, you know, Primark, you know, you can also prune them as well, too, you know, in early in the springtime to remove some of the excess canes. But if not, you know, if you really like to grow and you want to see a good crop, then try Primark varieties. And you know, select a good sunny spot, and which is very critical. And all at the same time, don't try it on a low-lying area or an area that you're going to have a lot of constantly. It's going to be very bad. So try somewhere it's a little bit dry. Give some a pretty good decent spacing, I would say, and make sure that you know you think about putting in a trellis system. You know, either you can build a simple like a V-shaped trellis or T-shaped trellis. You know. And try to train them in a trellis, you know, that'll be more important thing. Or if you do let them go like a bush, probably, you know, it's going to occupy the space very well, and it's going to trap a lot of humidity around to it. So just be aware about that.
Vijay Pandian, our guest today, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. We started by talking raspberries, blackberries, and boysenberries. I know we're going to get to asparagus as well. And certainly we want to answer your questions, too. If you have a gardening question for Vijay, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau's our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking all things in the garden today with Vijay Pandian, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I wanted to talk about asparagus. On a show recently, somebody asked me about, asked the guest about growing asparagus from seed, which I kind of was against in a way. But Vijay, do you want to comment on asparagus? It's certainly another tasty food to grow.
Yes. I mean, it's one of those, you know, early spring gardening crop that you can harvest them, you know, and I mean, everyone loves the taste of asparagus, you know, and it has a lot of medicinal benefit as well, too. Say, I mean, you can grow them from seed as well as a crown, but, you know, I prefer planting them by using a first-year-old crown rather than from seeds. I mean, the seeds ones, you know, it's hard to say whether you're going to get a male plant or a female plant, you know. Female plants can be very messy, you know, and because, you know, you produce some, it can become more weedy, actually. You know, when it becomes mature, it produces the weeds and it can sprout everywhere, you know, and it becomes weedy. At the same time, you know, it consumes so much energy, the spear quality may also go down as well, too. So that's the reason why it's best to get some, like, a male cultivar, male plants, you know, and so if you want to have a good yield and a good quality of spear production. But in terms of, you know, if you want to try to grow by seeds, you know, you can plant them in a bed and you can let them grow. And then after, you know, a year or so, you can scoop them out and you can plant them as well. But it's hard to say whether it's a male or female. So that's why many people prefer to go with a male type of variety. So when you think about male ones, you know, that are series, Jersey series, came up with a lot of different milk cultivars, like Jersey Knight, Jersey Supreme, Jersey Giant. So these are all very good milk cultivars. You can also plant it.
And what are some of the common mistakes gardeners make when they're trying to grow them?
The biggest thing is that they don't actually do proper weed management before planting.
I
hear a lot of complaints from home gardeners. After they're done with the planting, after a few years, the asparagus plant has been established, they get all this, you know, weed management type of questions. Either it may be some sort of like a grassy weeds or even a thistle, you know, invading the asparagus plant, or even some annual weeds invading the bed. So proper weed management before planting the bed is very critical. So you need to take care of those perennial weeds at least a year before you start thinking about, you know, planting them in the bed. So perennial weeds include like a thistles or even creeping charlie, or even you're thinking about any grassy weeds like quack grasses and all those things. So do those things. It will save you a lot of headache, you know, once the beds have been established. You know, so I think weed management is very, very critical. The second thing is that what can go wrong? See, asparagus is typically, you know, a weed. You know, if you look into it, it typically likes to grow in a weedy area, drought tolerant, salt tolerant. But one thing it really doesn't really like is wet seed. So don't plant this, you know, bed in a low-lying areas, you know, or in wet areas. That would really cause so many root rot type of issues. So that would be the number two, I would say, you know, choosing a wrong spot in your landscape and in your garden area. I mean, of course, you know, the third thing is that people, you know, like to try different varieties. But if you end up in growing some, you know, open pollinated varieties like Mary Washington, you know, all those things, you know, which has, you know, because asparagus is a male plant and a female plant. So if you don't know which one it is. And if you end up in growing a female plant, it produces a lot of seeds, like I said to you before, and those seeds become more like a weed. So trying to manage the crop that becomes a weed, you know, it becomes a big headache. So make sure you select the right type of variety, you know, male variety, you know, so that your crop doesn't end up becoming more of a weed. So these are the three things I would suggest to many homeowners before you're thinking about planting an asparagus.
As you were talking, I was thinking about when I was a kid, my dad had a raspberry bed or an asparagus bed. He tried to get to go, and it just wasn't doing well. So he got mad and just dug it all up. And my brother Mitch took some of them and stuck them in the sandbox that we had to play in, and they grew great. My dad was, how the heck did that happen? Anyway, it was well-drained, that was for sure. Peter in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my phone call. I have a question about thimbleberries, similar to raspberries, and I've struggled to get them to produce berries. I've got them from the UP, from Pennsylvania, the pink flowering ones. They're just beautiful. They'll bloom profusely, but never bear fruit. Can you help me?
So thimbleberry, you know, it's an amazing one, you know, because it gets about 8 feet tall and it really likes to grow. It's one of those berries that really likes to grow in a pot shaded environment. I mean, you can also grow in full sun, but really, you know, if you look at its, origin, you know, it really likes more in a shaded, pot shaded environment. And the flowers looks really amazingly well. And the thimbleberry, you know, probably, you know, it's one of those one which has an open, you know, open pollinated one. I mean, so, you know, self pollinated type. So if you did not get any fruits off it, you know, the only problem I would think about is something might have been wrong with the pollination. Say, either, you know, it didn't get enough pollinated by somehow, or something that's acting as a barrier in preventing it from pollination. So that would be the only thing that I could think of right now why you didn't get the fruit. And how long have you been growing them? Do you know? Is it like a more than multiple years, or it's been like recently planted?
Years. I've collected them from the UP, from Pennsylvania. Interesting, the people up in UP, I talked to a park ranger, and they said, you'll never get them to grow in Wisconsin. And I think they alluded to something having to do with the latitude, that they're very light specific. But then if they grow in Pennsylvania, that might be further south. I don't know. It's a quest of mine to get them. They are beautiful. The flowers are fantastic. You might be right. Maybe I need more shade. They are in the sun in my lot, but I've been trying for probably 10 years, and they grow. Yeah. They multiply they're just very aggressive, but no. And they seem to have, you know, the little drupelets when they're young, mm-hmm. but then they'll dry up.
See, I think, we can grow thimbleberry in Wisconsin. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I planted it, I got it from one of the local nurseries and planted it. It's amazing. It grows really very well. And I planted it in a shaded area, and it started producing flowers. I mean, this year, but it didn't set any fruit last year because it was recently planted. If you happen to get the drupelet, but it's not in a good size, probably something went wrong with the pollination. That's the only thing that I can do. And even though thimbleberry is a self-pollinating one, I'm kind of thinking maybe, if you plant it with some other, type of thimbleberries or something like that may help, maybe beneficial, could be. One other thing I would also think about is that see if you could actually get another thimbleberry variety and see if you can able to plant it nearby and see if it can help some pollination.
Yeah, that's good advice. Peter, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Larry. Like your program. I've got a question for your guest. Two questions, but the first one is on asparagus. What do you do with the dead stalks from last year?
So the dead stock from the last year, it is better to get rid of it. So especially in asparagus, they got an insect issue, pest issue called the asparagus beetle. And if you know that you have this issue with the asparagus beetle, either you burn it or you trash it. Because those, beetles can lay the eggs on the stalk of it, and sometimes it can habitat. The adults can overwinter actually as well, too, on the stalk of it. So you better you get rid of it. So, you do some kind of pruning in the late fall and get rid of those dead stalks.
All right. There you go, Eric. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-064-2124. And I've just remembered that I think Eric might have had a second question. Eric, are you still there?
I sure am. How high do I cut that, or how low do I cut the stalk down to?
You can cut the stalk, probably about, an inch above the ground. You can cut it all the way, about an inch or two above the ground.
All right. There you go, Eric. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Rachel in Milwaukee's wondering how the pawpaw trees in the Kenosha Extension Garden are doing, and what have you learned so far about trying to grow pawpaws in Wisconsin?
Say, that's a very interesting question, because I planted this pawpaw, a couple of different varieties. I got it from Young's Nursery, and it's a bare root this type, it's slow growing, very slow growing, but it survived. I planted it in one of the open areas where it gets really, in a heavy soil, get blasted by wind, and I thought I'm going to lose it. But amazingly, it really withstood the drought in 2021. We had one of the extreme drought. It survived the drought, and it survived the winter. We never had any winter damage on those young papa vips. But it's been extremely slow growing one. And that seems to be testing my patience. But when I was in Green Bay, I mean, the Green Bay Botanical Garden had an amazing papa shrub over there. As well as Buena Botanical Garden also have a huge pawpaw shrub, you know, that, and it produced fruits, actually, too. I mean, in Buena Botanical Garden, they've been growing as a hedge, actually, in one of their garden areas. So, and pruning could be an issue for them because it's overgrown. Yes, we can grow pawpaw in Wisconsin, so, yes.
Well, Kathy in northern Wisconsin emailed to say she has an old crabapple tree in front of her house, and there's a hole in its bark, so the bark's been taken away about 6 inches by 8 inches at the base, probably chewed on by some animal. And she wonders, how should she care for it? They want to keep this tree as the birds just love it. The old crabapple tree.
Yeah, so, usually, if the bark has been damaged, here's a general thumb rule. If you happen to have, still more than 50% of healthy bark that has been still intact and it has not been chewed, that's a very good chance the tree will recover from the injury. And, as long as there are some healthy green bark, in the inner green bark that is still intact to it, it will recover. But if you happen to have, that has been chewed all the way around to it, then it gets very, dicey right up here in the sense that the tree may likely fail. It may produce a bud, and the buds may open up because they have, each bud has its own, self-stored energy. And that may help in pushing the buds out and open up. But after it opens up, it has to depend on the root system for the nutrients and water. And if they go, the pipeline is cut off, then probably they will wilt. So some people do some bridge grafting, in apples. Crab apple belongs in the apple family, very closely related to it. So you can actually do some bridge grafting, technique. If you are experienced in grafting skills, you can try that. Or, there are plenty of YouTube videos these days, Larry, that you can watch and get experience as well, too. So, again, it can. But one thing I would say, be patient. Let's see, how it does in early summer, in June, how your tree behaves, whether it recovers from the injury or not. Before you end up in doing any drastic measures, whether you want to cut down the tree or cut down this part of the trunk, you can think about it later on. But be patient for now. In the meantime, do some protective measure. If you want to put up a hardware fence around to it or something to protect any further more damages, so spring is that,
Yeah. And we'd say, and you'd probably say, and don't paint that wound either.
No. Pruning paint is not going to help anything like these things. Let the wound naturally, seal itself, we don't advocate anymore using pruning paint only in ornamental trees like oaks and, elms, because if you tend to prune them during the off season, you want to prevent some of those, sap beetles getting attracted towards it. That's the only case we recommend those pruning paint. But in rest of the trees are, we don't recommend it at all. In fact, it acts like more of a barrier in preventing the trees from properly sealing the wound.
Yeah. BJ Pandy and our guest garden question for him, give us a call. We'll get you on really quickly here. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Bonnie in Waukesha emailed. She planted the bush and berry blackberries and raspberries last year, and she's wondering, and we talked a bit about this, but probably bears repeating a bit, how should they be pruned to maximize fruiting?
So in raspberries, this is where, you know, they have launched up a new series called shortcake varieties, okay? And so these raspberry shortcakes, you know, are amazing one. You know, so if you have a very tight space, probably, you know, these raspberry shortcakes variety, which is the bush and bush ones that can be planted. And it does really very well. So the only thing is that, you know, you don't stress the plant out, even though it's a short, compact varieties, you know, they don't tend to do really well in drought time. So we lost one of them in 2021 drought. And so so make sure you do some proper watering and mulching those things. And in terms of pruning, you know, again, you know, these are like a summer bearing raspberry type, except it, instead of growing 4 or 5 feet tall, you know, it's more like 2 or 3 feet tall. So just like I told you, just summer bearing varieties, not a fall bearing, summer bearing varieties, you need to prune them twice. So in the middle, after you did with the final harvest, cut off the canes actually that produce the fruit. And then probably before the, in the early in the springtime, before the bud break happens up, here's one thing I would suggest to you, especially in the shortcake variety, is that, you know, you can thin some of the excess cane. So if you feel that the bush is too thick, then you can thin some of those primal canes, okay? But, yeah, not necessarily, you know, you don't have to thin too much to a regular type of summer-bearing raspberries where you thin them about 4 to 5 sturdy canes per foot. No, this one, you know, probably thin only some of those excess canes, which really crowds them in the middle portion of those of the bush. So, and that's pretty much about it you can do. Treat them more like a, you know, like a compact, you know, bush. How you prune those things.
And as long as we're talking about pruning a little bit, let's switch over to trees for a minute. It's still okay to prune trees and shrubs.
So most trees, yes, you know, you can prune them. So far in southern part of Wisconsin, we still haven't had the bud break happen, you know. But the saps are actively flowing. So if you're pruning any of your maples and, you know, walnuts or even, you know, birch trees, you know, you can still think about pruning. You will see some of the sap bleeding out from the cut ends, which is very natural. You don't have to panic. It'll dry out pretty soon when the in late in the spring or early summer, it'll dry out. So, but exception is oaks and elms, especially the oaks. The DNR has an ordinance that not to prune the oaks from, you know, April, May, and June, July, I would say. But check with the municipality. Every municipality has their own ordinance when to when not to prune your oak trees. Generally during the growing season, beginning in springtime from April till about like, you know, end of, you know, September or October, you know, you should not prune your oak trees. And same thing with the elm trees too, especially if you have Native American elm trees, then generally you should not prune. The reason is oaks are vulnerable to oak wilt disease and elms are vulnerable to Dutch elm diseases as well. So other than that, for most of the other trees, yes, you know, you can still schedule the pruning. Now, when it comes to shrubs, you know, again, you need to remember what time of the year these shrubs bloom. So if it is actually a summer blooming shrub, then you can schedule the pruning right now. And if it is a spring blooming shrub, you can prune them after it's done with the blooming. For example, like lilac, which typically blooms in late in the spring, you know. So you can schedule the pruning, you know, after it's done with the blooming, you know, after like first week or second week in June, you can prune those things.
And with the lilacs, just as I mentioned, when we're pruning them, we're taking the biggest stalks down to the ground, correct?
Yeah, if it's a standard type of like a Chinese lilac type, lilac, which is pretty much overgrown, you know, say what you can do is that we call in a, as a, you know, renewal pruning where, you know, you can cut some of the older stalk all the way down to the ground. So if you do have, you know, multiple older stalks, you never pruned it, you know, for last multiple years, let's say that. you can cut actually some of the older stocks all the way to the ground and remember about one-third principal. So if you have six older stocks, then in a year you can take two of them at a time and then schedule the remaining two for next year. So in this way, you gradually thin out some of the older stock. And in that way, you know, you're not actually, ruining the shrub. At the same time, you know, you're providing more space for the newer shoots to come out from the ground.
Yeah, and it is amazing the difference that makes, that pruning, in terms of the number of flowers and so forth. Absolutely amazing. Dave in northern Wisconsin, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Dave.
How's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thank you. I just wanted to know if at this latitude, I lived it in Pacific Northwest for the longest time, if salmon berries will grow.
Salmon berries.
I haven't heard about it in Wisconsin, so I'm not really sure whether it's going to be really hardy for our area. Salmon berries, no, I haven't. But if you do try it, you know, let me know. I'll be happy to hear from it.
Dave, you know, you're a gardener. You're going to experiment a little bit. Why not try some and just see what happens? And then let us know.
Absolutely. As a gardener, it's all about trial and error. You know, it'd be good to know, actually, when you try all this type of, unique berries. And only by trying, you can, know that, whether it's really hardy for Wisconsin or not, how easy it is to grow, how to prune it. So that's how I have learned quite a bit, about growing boysenberries or, other type of unique berries in southeast part of Wisconsin.
Yeah. Dave, thank you so much. Give it a try. Vijay Pandian, our guest today. Vijay's a horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here visiting with Vijay Pandian, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. You can join him. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Joel in Stevens Point. We'll give you a chance. Hi, Joel.
Hey. Hi, I got trouble growing honeyberries. They grow for about a month, then they'll just kind of die off. So I don't know what's too much fertilizer or not enough.
Oh, that's interesting. Honeyberries are one of the easiest crops to grow. And, I'm very surprised that, it dies off. The only thing, you can cause the honeyberries to die is if you plant them in a wet area, or if you happen to have too much moisture hanging around it, it can, get root rot and it can die. Otherwise, it's a very least maintenance type of crop. It needs full sun, and it's just, it doesn't matter. It's not picky on whether it's an acid soil, alkaline soil, it's not picky about either. Say, check your soil moisture. Or even pull one of those dead plant and send a sample to a disease diagnostic clinic, Dr. Brian Harrison lab, and get it tested for root rot. I think that would be the primary suspect. I would have a primary suspect on root rot for it.
Yeah, they're pretty easy to grow. And I think that's really good advice. The Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW, Joel, would be the place to go. I would just put in UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, and it's going to pop up, and you're going to be able to follow the directions there for getting that information to Brian Huddleston. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Bill in Milwaukee, we'll go to you next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So, Bishop's weed. The only way I've found to get rid of it is to cover it for a full season with, say, black plastic. But I have a lot of it embedded with my hostas. Got a perimeter of hostas. Great plant for that. But this bishop's weed is completely within the hosta rows. Any way to get rid of that other than every year, a few times a year, pulling it?
Wow, you've got one of those nastiest weeds, I would say.
That's what I was thinking.
Lazy weed. Bishop's weed, bishop's goat weed, you know, it comes with different names. And, you know, it was introduced as an ornamental ground cover, and that is a variegated version of it as well. They, like you said, you know, this is one of the tough weeds to control. It's, you know, it has, you know, extensive, you know, rhizomes, and it's hard to get rid of it. Say, I mean, it's very good to know that, you know, you've been trying actually by smothering it with some black plastic, you know, and see how it grows. The thing about it is that this bishop's goldweed is a perennial weed, which means that you can have, you know, there's a lot of energy that has been stored in its root system, and that's why it can keep coming back again and again. And so if you have this gout weed integrated or it has been, you know, growing around with your other desired plant, probably mowing or hand, you know, pulling or cutting them down is not going to help. That's going to invigorate the bush to come back again more and more, you know, because of the energy that has been stored in its root system. But like you said, you know, you can try by smothering it by see, like you have, you know, you experimented by using a thick black plastic sheet or a, you know, thick landscape fabric around the bush and pin them down to the ground, you know, for a certain number of, you know, a year or a couple of years and see what happens. The other option I would suggest is using a spot treatment with Roundup. You know, you have to be extremely careful in using it. Say, sometimes what you can do, you can use a kitchen sponge and dip it actually into the solution and dab it onto the foliage of the plant. The timing is very crucial. If you do it during the growing season, it won't happen anything because it's just going to burn the foliage and it's going to replace it again with some more new growth. So do it in the fall time. Probably, I would say, about, you know, late in the September, mid to late September, because that's the time many of the plants, the perennial plant, including the bishop's goutweed, you know, moves all its nutrients back to its root system. And it's going to think that the herbicide is also part of the root, you know, nutrient. It's going to drag it all the way to the root system, and you can see some of the injuries happening out. But that doesn't mean that during the growing season, you can simply keep on, you know, keep an eye watching them, you know, to grow. You can keep mowing them or cutting them down or weakening them, like using a black plastic sheet or something like that. Whatever you try, you weaken the plant. But, you know, if you do want to treat it, you know, using an herbicide, do it in the, you know, late, in the fall time, mid to late fall time. That would be the best way to go.
Yeah, hard to do that when it's in a hosta bed like that because you've got those, all the hostas right around it and it's kind of growing up through the hosta leaves. So cutting might be the best, cutting, just keep cutting it back and keep it shaded. You know, the hostas should keep it shaded, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, the shade is not going to have any impact onto it. You know, it's going to overgrow them.
Yeah.
But at least, you know, if you can able to cut them down and be very extremely careful by, you know, and you don't have to spray it actually on the foliage. You just dip the sponge in a solution around the solution. And you just, you know, paint it actually on the foliage of the bishop's goutweed in the fall time may also help. In that way, you can prevent any drift happening up to your hosta plant or any other desired plant that you have.
Yeah. Bill, good luck. Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Tom in Green Bay. Tom, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, VJ. When you were on before, about a year ago, year and a half, 2 years ago, you had a mix for soil mix for blueberries.
Oh, and you want to grow some blueberries in Green Bay, Tom. All right.
Well, good to hear from you, Tom. You know, I remember you. Yes, Blueberries are one of my passion, and we've been growing down in a soilless media, even still in Kenosha. This year, I've been trying growing them in a raised bed in a soilless media. So the recipe for a soilless media is you can use a pine bark or a pine needle, not anything else. So you can get this pine bark, you know, like a mini nugget pine bark or a regular pine bark. Mix it up with some pine peat. So one part of pine bark or pine needles, and then one part of peat, your regular peat. You know, you get it any garden center, you know, in a bale of it. And then put some in a perlite. So the perlite is just a white, fluffy material that you typically use in a potting mix and stuff like that. You can get a bag of that. So one part, pine bark or pine needle, pine peat, one part, and or perlite. So mix all these three ingredients together and then sprinkle some sulfur along with it, elemental sulfur. And then there you go. So you got the media. So the best thing to do actually, you know, is to grow those blueberries in a trench system. In a trench, you dig a trench about, or a pit about like, you know, 10 inches deep or 12 inches deep. And probably about like a 4 feet wide. So, and you put this, you know, media in it. Before you put this media, you spread your landscape fabric. So if you have any tree roots or any other perennial weeds, you don't want those roots to creep into your soilless media. So to prevent that, you drape the trench, you know, with some landscape fabric and pin it to the ground. And then put those, you know, soilless media into it, and you plant those blueberries in the trench.
Good luck with that, Tom. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Eric emailed, he'd love to start an urban garden in his small backyard in Madison. You recommend any specific online references to maximize the square footage?
So we do actually have a list of publications that you can actually get it from our extension website on how to start a small urban garden, or if you're new to gardening, we do have a kit, a gardening publication kit. So you go to our website, horticulture.extension.vis.edu website, or you just type in UW-Madison Extension Horticulture in a Google, and it leads to a landing page, and we have some of the basic fundamental gardening publications and fact sheets listed on our website for gardening for beginners as well. Now, you know, if you thinking about, you know, maximizing your small space in an urban area, growing them in a raised bed would be a best option, I would say.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you know, time efficient, I would say. You know, you don't have to worry about managing weeds, probably, you know, thinking about, do we need to have a large space, or do we have to, you know, spend that much time in managing a garden? So raised bed planting would be a best option. You know, you don't have to till it very much. So now I tried two different ways of growing vegetable crops in a raised bed using two different type of media. So generally, you know, raised beds, you have a bed height about like 10 to 12 inches high, and about, you know, 4 feet minimum, you need to have a 4 feet, width of the bed. Say some gardeners use, you know, one part of topsoil and one part of compost or any type of, you know, organic matter. So 1:1 type of ratio, they use those things. I've also grown in a soilless media purely with, you know, peat and perlite mixed into it, or compost mixed into it. So peat, compost, and perlite mixed into it. Both those medias are really great for a raised bed system. But over time, I find that each of those media has its own pros and cons. So using the topsoil mixed with some compost, you know, it is cheaper. And you can mix it really easily well. But over time, what happens is that the topsoil settles down and becomes a little more compact. So you need to use some garden trowels or shovel to flip it and put some more compost to it. So yep. That is a downside.
Yeah, that's a downside.
If you go with a soilless media using compost, peat, and perlite, it is easy to mix. It's more fluffy, arable. The garden crops grows really very well, you know, because of the porous space it has. And the good thing is that you don't need to till it, or you don't need to have to use a trowel or a shovel, even in the springtime every year, to loosen the soil. The soil is good to go. You know, you can plant them right away. But the downside is if you have a very dry summertime, the media tends to dry out very quickly. So you need to water it, at least once a day, to do that. So each of those media has its own kind of pros and cons.
Vijay Pandian, our guest today. Vijay is a horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. He's been with us many times here on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Have you with us on the Ideas Network for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Vijay Pandian, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. So we're talking everything in the garden right now, and I hope you'll join in with your own gardening question. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And let's take a call. Norman in Wausau has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Hi, Norman.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask your distinguished guest there whether he has any suggestions as to how to get my muskmelons to ripen. I grow early dew honeydew, which really does seem to do pretty well, and some of those do ripen, but my regular muskmelons, Aphrodite is one I like to grow. It's a nice big melon, but they grow real big, and then the entire month of August, they just don't want to turn yellow and sweet.
Where do you live?
Wausau.
Depends on Wausau. Okay. In here in southern part of Wisconsin, we have about 110 growing days, on average. And sometimes, growing this, muskmelon, cantaloupes, they may actually, need a little bit of more extra warm weather or growing weather, for them to ripe. So the first thing I would say is that make sure you, plant them, at the right timing. Don't delay your planting. So I would start planting by late May, early in June, when your soil temperature starts getting about 65, 70 degrees, which usually don't happen till about first week in June. So you get those things. Or you can purchase some seedlings, and maybe that might really help actually in speeding up, your harvesting. So you can get some seedlings and you can also plant them as well. The second thing is that, don't let these, crowd them too much. So sometimes, if you don't give enough spacing for these plants, they actually, crowd with each other. And sometimes when you do have some excess crowding, it can also, help sometimes smother the fruit actually and delay in the ripening process, because you also want to have some good amount of light exposure, so that can also help in spurring up some of the ripening process of those fruits. So think about giving some optimum spacing for it as well. And, you know, check the rind and see, you know, if the rind actually has started to change its color. That usually gives you a pretty good indication that, you know, if it's ready for harvest or not. Yes.
Yeah, that rind. And I was just going to bring up, if you're looking at the number of days on the seed packet, from planting to harvest, you might want to take a look at, I don't know the growing days in Wausau, but there'd be less than what you were talking about, VJ. So even though you like the one kind, you might want to try one that maybe is an earlier harvest date.
Yeah, definitely check the, you know, your seed packet and check, you know, the number of growing degree days that we have, you know, see if it's optimum, you know, for your area that, you know, that would be my suggestion, you know, why you may not have enough days to, you know, let them to mature. Because we are talking about these melons, you know, they're all tropical vegetables. They really love heat. And if you don't, in the fall time, if you don't have enough heat, probably that will really delay in its maturity.
Good luck, Norm. Thank you very much for calling, Norman. I appreciate it. Kathy in Stone Lake, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I have a question about blueberry bushes also. I have twice had a bed of blueberries. And after some years, they get what's called as a witch's broom, and then they become unproductive. And I've saw online that that's a fungal disease related to fir trees, and I have a lot of balsam firs around my property. I'm wondering, are there any resistant cultivars that I could grow?
So the first thing I would ask, actually, is that, you know, take a photograph or send a sample of those witch's broom to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, to Brian Huddleston's lab, and to confirm it. You know, typically witch's broom, you know, is caused by not a fungal, it's another type of group called phytoplasma. And it's kind of related to, you know, like sort of like a virus, you know, it's related to that. So just send a sample. I haven't heard about it on blueberries, so it'll be very interesting to hear from you. Or you can send a photograph of that to me as well, too. I'll take a look into it. And since you've been growing for, like, last 2 years and third year, you know, this happens. The few things I would suggest, you know, see if you could disinfect a pruning tool. Say, you know, sometimes, most of the time, many of those virus and phytoplasmas are transmitted actually through some pruning tool. So disinfect your pruning tool, you know, with using some Lysol or any type of wipes, you know, or even rubbing alcohol would be the best. And the third thing is that, you know, I would also, you know, recommend to pull the infected plant, you know, cut it, remove it from the patch before it starts spreading to your other healthy ones. And if you're doing so, then send the sample to Brian and get it tested to confirm it, whether you really have the phytoplasma, which causes the witch's broom effect, or something else has went wrong in it. So, but I haven't heard about phytoplasma infection on blueberries, but in a home garden situation, but it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, for sure. And Brian Huddleston, the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, if you type that into your search engine, it's going to pop right up to give you the instructions, Kathy. Thank you so much for calling. John in Elgin, Illinois, we'll turn to you next. Hi, John.
Hi. I want to start raspberries in my garden this year. I want to transplant them from a friend's well-established bed. When do I do that, and how high should the little sprouts be before I dig them out?
Okay. So my piece of suggestion would be is if your friend or a neighbor or, you know, have a well-established raspberry patch and it has been old patch, especially if it's more than 10, 15 years old, my best suggestion, not to get any of those things from them. Many times, these older raspberry patches do have, you know, some infection, virus, and any other diseases. And so getting those type of, you know, transplants from those older patches, you're actually naturally going to, you know, bring those viruses or bacterials or whatever the diseases into your garden, and it's going to infect them as well, too. So it is best not to do so. Rather, I would get a new patch or start a new plant from getting from a local nurseries, you know, and grow them. Because most of those, you know, plants are certified to be virus-free, and you can start them. And they are very young, and they're very vigorous. So generally, raspberries tend to be more productive for about like 15, 20 years. After that, it loses its productivity. So even if you're getting some from the older patches, you know, we don't know whether it's going to be very vigorous or not. So keep that in mind. But if you still persist, okay, you know, I really want to get it from my plant. It is very good, and you feel that it is safe. And, you know, if you do want it, then definitely spring is the best time. Before the bud break happen, it's the best time to transplant it. So when you do transplant it, you know, transplant some of those, you know, at least it needs to have the crown that you're going to, you know, get it from the ground, you know, make sure it has enough root and it has a crown. It has at least 2 to 3 canes coming up from the crown. So don't try to get a crown which has like only one cane, which is a primer cane that's emerging. Also, make sure to know what type of raspberry is it. Is it a red raspberry or a black raspberries or purple raspberries or yellow raspberries, or even within the red raspberries, whether it's a summer bearing or ever bearing. Oftentimes, if you don't know what it is, pruning is going to be very hard. I all the time get questions about, you know, I got a red raspberry and I really don't know how to prune it. The first question I ask is a summer bearing or ever bearing, and many times homeowner doesn't know that. Then I have asked, when is the best time when they start producing the fruits, you know, and that's where, you know, you can able to determine whether it's ever bearing or summer bearing, because summer bearing produce a bumper crop in July and ever bearing in late in the season. So get to know all these details from your neighbor or your friend before, and take a careful consideration, see how old this patch is, see if there is a healthy patch. If it seems to be a very old patch, I would tend to avoid it. But still, if you persist it, then, you know, it's up to you. You're going to take the risk. But spring is the best time before the bud break happens, the best time to transplant it.
Good luck, John. Thank you for calling. Don in Cottage Grove will move to you next. Hi, Don.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Leslie and I really enjoy your show. Quick question. On the seed package, it gives a date to maturity. Like in corn, it'll sometimes say 65 days or 82 days. So when does the calendar start? Does it start when you put the seed in the ground, or does it start when the seed breaks the surface?
That's a very good question. So if it is a reputable seed company, they will print actually in the seed packet, you know, the number of days to, you know, for ready for harvest, you know, in your seed packet. So they'll say 60 days, 90, 80 days, 90 days. When it gets close to 90 days or 100 days, you know, then you need to be a little bit more careful about it. So like I said before, you know, we have a maximum, I would say, an average of 110 at the maximum in southern part of Wisconsin. So so try to get a, you know, varieties which are ready for harvest, you know, less than 100 days, I would say. Now, you know, if you're going to do some, you know, direct planting of the seeds in the ground, say the day that you they germinate, that's where it begins. The time clock starts the day it germinates, not the day you see it. It's the day when, you know, you see the cotyledons popping out. That's where, you know, it starts the counting for the number of days for harvesting begins. Yes.
Yep. There you go. Thank you so much, Don, for calling. Appreciate it. On to George in Bailey's Harbor. George, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was listening to the show earlier, and you had some information about and questions about thimbleberries, and someone there was a comment about how you can't grow them in Wisconsin. And I live in Bailey's Harbor, which is in Door County in Wisconsin. And in the spring and summer, we have thimbleberries all over our neighborhood. So you certainly can grow them in Wisconsin because we see them here all the time.
I think the caller was calling from the other caller was calling from Door County as well.
Yeah, the question about the other caller was regarding to the pollination of it. They're not getting enough food, so it is not about the hardiness of thimbleberry. Yes, you can grow thimbleberries in Wisconsin. You know, a few years ago when I was at the Larry Miller Show, some callers from northern part of Wisconsin also called about it. Yes, we can grow thimbleberries here in Wisconsin, absolutely. It is about the pollination, why it's not able to set any food. So that's why, you know, we suggested to plant, different, at least more than one thimbleberries to help in beneficial pollination purpose.
There you go, George. By the way, do you get thimbleberries?
I've tasted them, but they're so incredibly fragile. You know, when you pick them and you've got them in your hand, if you give them a dirty look, they just fall apart.
You're right about that, George. You're kind of right about that. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Mary wonders, and actually called, couldn't stay with us, but wondering about hyacinths. She wants to start hyacinths in the house. How do you start hyacinths in the house?
So, the thing about, many of the hyacinth bulbs that you get, make sure, you get a decent-sized bulb, a large enough bulb. And you need to chill them, at least for a couple of months, So you place it in a refrigerator, not in the freezer, in a refrigerator, that way it gets temperature 35 to 45 degrees Fahrenheit. And you chill them, and then you can actually, plant them in a potting media. And sometimes, if you already have a pre-chilled bulb, you can also, grow them actually with some little water to it. It'll start to sprout out and produce some, flowers. So once it produces flowers, you can enjoy it and you plant them. Make sure, you feed it back again with some regular fertilizer. Because, after it's done with the blooming, it does need a lot of nutrients so that it can able to store them back into the bulb for next season bloom. So, yes, you can grow them in the house, but, it does need some little bit more maintenance, I would say.
Bonnie in Wanakee emailed, she has raised beds for her vegetable garden, and last fall she covered the beds with shredded maple and oak leaves. The soil in the beds has settled. Should she add composted manure to the beds until the whole works together, or top off the beds with composted manure and topsoil and not till it, letting the leaf layer compost like with lasagna gardening?
So oftentimes, in fall, when we get all this excess leaves, either we add it back into the vegetable garden, typically, we lay it actually on the surface of the soil, It would be nice actually those leaves are shredded and laid on top of it so it decomposes rather than actually just leaving it, naturally, because it takes a while for them to decompose and to do that. Now, the thing about, is that most of this leaf materials, they decompose. If it's shredded, it decomposes really quickly. And but you want to make sure that those shredded leaf materials, that has been decomposed has been tilled back into the garden. So make sure that in the springtime, you flip them actually either using a garden trowel or a shovel. Flip those, decomposed materials at least about 3 to 6 inches into the soil. Again, it all depends upon how, what is the depth of those, leaf materials that you have piled on your vegetable garden last year. If it's a little pile, maybe about a couple of inches, then maybe you might need some, extra more organic matter. So that's why, you can also get some or compost or, rocky manure. And you can do that at the same time when you're tilling some of those decomposed leaves back again. So in a raised bed situation, you need to have at least about, 2 to 3 inches of decomposed organic matter, and you slip it about like 4 or 5 inches, into the bed. So that would be the good day to go, in incorporating some organic matter into your garden bed.
And Andy in Fort Atkinson has a golden delicious apple tree. The trunk has a dead area from the base to the first branches. A couple of the branches died last summer. He wonders what causes this and if there's anything he can do to stop it. Golden delicious apple tree.
So the first thing I would do is to take a photograph of those, branches, and as well as the trunk of the tree, So either you can send it to Dr. Brian Hilson Lab or send it to your local extension agent's, office. And so oftentimes, apples or any trees that have a smooth bark, they can also get an injury, a winter injury called sun scald injury, that in the south-facing bark, you see a crack or split happens up and the cold air gets into it, or sometimes during the growing season, diseases can get into it. And that can actually kill some of the branches because, the water pipeline system is cut off, so it can affect your branches and stuff like that. That can happen. That's one possibility. The second possibility all the time is in apples, the fire blight is a huge concern. So, just keep an eye on to the fire blight and see what happens. Do you have a Shepherd Crook symptoms or the leaves are still clinging on to those branches? Check into those things. Those could be a good indication, or any sap that's oozing out from those branches, check into that. Also sometimes, canker diseases can also happen too. Again, that's why the photograph might help us out in diagnosing those issues. Or sometimes the other natural things if you have area that you haven't weeded and you haven't watered it very well and it has been severely stressed out, that can also happen as well too, can also, cause the decline of the branches. So there are multiple factors can happen. I think we need some more evidence, a photographic evidence to properly narrow down what could be the factor that plays in declining of those branches.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Bill in Oregon emailed that there are quite a few pawpaw growers in the Madison area, several in his neighborhood, and here are some general tips. Pawpaw trees, they like acid soil, they like mulch, and they prefer part shade. They struggle in full sun without extra water, and they do best at elevation, preferably on a slight grade to avoid cold air pooling around them. So there we go.
Absolutely. Those are excellent tips. And, it does grow in, wide range of soil, not only in acid soil, but in alkaline soil too. Pretty much in southern part of Wisconsin, most of the southern part of Wisconsin, in Madison or Green Bay or in Milwaukee area, we have pretty much an alkaline soil, and it tends to grow very well there too. It's not that very picky, but, it does need some good yaflow movement, and so if you do plant in an open area, make sure to water it very well.
There you go. VJ, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. VJ Pandy, an horticulture educator for UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. We'll have him back and we'll do this again with him. Monday, we'll talk about epigenetics, the study of how behaviors and the environment can affect the way our genes work. And we'll also look at the relationship between climate change and the size of trout in streams. That's Monday at 11. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. We'll see you next week.